Hello and welcome back to First Pages Readings, where books are celebrated as cultural messengers. And thanks for joining me. Today's episode features three novels, books written by an American author whose paternal great-grandfather was Chinese, a German author, and an author from Argentina. Today's first book is The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane by Lisa C. This coming-of-age story is also a story of identity within China's Akka ethnic minority community. The storytelling is mesmerizing and captivating. History, culture, and mythology are beautifully depicted as the book addresses topics like tea-growing traditions, family bonds, international adoption, and more. Published in 2017, this is an original and engaging novel. The first page of The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane. A Dog on the Roof. No coincidence, no story, my Ama recites. And that seems to settle everything, as it usually does, after First Brother finishes telling us about the dream he had last night. I don't know how many times my mother has used this praising aphorism during the 10 years I've been on this earth. I also feel as though I've heard versions of First Brother's dream many times. A poor farmer carries freshly picked turnips to the market town to barter for salt. He takes a misstep and tumbles down a cliff. This could have ended in a terrible death far from home, the worst thing that can happen to an Akka person. But instead, he lands in the camp of a wealthy salt seller. The salt seller brews tea. The two men start talking, and the coincidence could have been anything. The salt seller will now marry the farmer's daughter, or the farmer's fall protected him from being washed away in a flood. This time, the farmer was able to trade with the salt seller without having to walk all the way to the market town. It was a good dream with no bad omens, which pleases everyone seated on the floor around the fire pit. As Ama said, every story, every dream, every waking minute of our lives is filled with one fateful coincidence after another. People and animals and leaves and fire and rain, we whirl around each other like handfuls of dried rice kernels being tossed into the sky. A single kernel cannot change its direction. It cannot choose to fly to the right or to the left, nor can it choose where it lands. Balanced on a rock, and therefore salvageable, or bouncing off that same rock into the mud, becoming instantly useless and valueless. Where they alight is fate, and nothing, no thing anyway, can change their destinies. Second brother is next in line to tell his dream. It is ordinary. Third brother recites his dream, which is worse than dull. Abba nudges me with his elbow. Girl, tell us a dream you had last night. My dream? The request surprises me, because neither of my parents has asked this of me before. I'm just a girl, unimportant, as I've been told many times. Why Abba has chosen this day to single me out, I don't know, but I hope to be worthy of the attention. I was walking back to the village after picking tea. It was already dark. I could see smoke rising from household fires. The smell of the food should have made me hungry. I'm always hungry. But my stomach, eyes, arms, and legs were all happy to know I was where I was supposed to be, our ancestral home. I watch my family's faces. I want to be honest, but I can't alarm anyone with the truth. What else did you see? Ama asks. In our village, power and importance go in this order. The headman, the Ruma, the spirit priest, who keeps harmony between spirits and humans, and the Nima, the shaman, who has the ability to go into a trance, visit the trees God planted in the spirit world to represent each soul on earth, and then determine which incantations can be used to heal or enhance vitality. These men are followed next by all grandfathers, fathers, and males of any age. My mother is ranked first among women not only in our village, but on the entire mountain. She is a midwife and so much more. treating men, women, and children as they pass through their lives. She's also known for her ability to interpret dreams. The silver balls that decorate her headdress tremble, catching the firelight as she waits for my response. The others bend their heads over their bowls, nervous for me. I force myself to speak. I dreamed of a dog. Everyone prickles at this revelation. We allow dogs to live among us for three reasons, Amma says reassuringly, trying to settle the family. They are essential for sacrifices. They alert us to bad omens, and they are good to eat. What kind was yours? Today's next book is Go, Went, Gone by German writer Jenny Erpenbeck, translated by Susan Bernofsky. This is a timeless yet contemporary story that has unique yet universal themes, while the book tells two merging stories. With clear and plain-spoken language, the narrative conveys the internal world of Richard, who is a widowed and retired classics professor, while the book also tells the stories of asylum seekers from the African continent. As the novel unfolds, it explores diverse topics like race, language, social justice, the limitations of law, as well as considering the path of personal evolution. This complex book that was published in 2015 and translated from German in 2017 is a timely and thought-provoking novel. The first pages of Go, Went, Gone. Perhaps many more years still lie before him, or perhaps only a few. In any case, from now on, Richard will no longer have to get up early to appear at the Institute. As of today, he has time, plain and simple. Time to travel, people say, to read books, Proust, Dostoevsky. Time to listen to music. He doesn't know how long it'll take him to get used to having time. In any case, his head still works just the same as before. What's he going to do with the thoughts still thinking away inside his head? He's had his share of success, and now, at least what passes for success. He's published books and been invited to conferences, his lectures always filled up. Students were assigned his books to read, highlighting passages to learn by heart for their exam. Where are his students now? Some hold junior faculty positions. Two or three are even tenured. Others he hasn't heard about in years. There's one he's still friendly with, and a few others drop him a line periodically. That's how it is. From his desk, he sees the lake. Richard makes coffee. Cup in hand, he goes out to the backyard to check for new molehills. The lake lies placid before him, as it has all summer long. Richard is waiting, but he doesn't know for what. Time is now completely different. Suddenly different, he thinks. And then he thinks that, obviously, he can't stop thinking. The thinking is what he is, and at the same time, it's the machine that governs him. Even if he's all alone with his head now, he can't just stop thinking. Obviously, even if no one gives a hoot what he thinks. For a brief moment, he imagines an owl using its beak to flip the pages of his study. The concept of the world in the work of Lucretius. He goes back in. He asks himself whether it's too warm to be wearing a blazer. Does he even need a blazer if he's just puttering around the house alone? Years ago, when he learned by chance that his lover was cheating on him, the only thing that helped him get over his disappointment was turning this disappointment into work. For months, he made her behavior his object of inquiry. He wrote almost 100 pages, investigating all the factors that led up to the betrayal, as well as the way in which the young woman had carried it out. His work had no particular impact on their relationship, as she left him for good not long after. But still, these labors got him through the first few months after his discovery, months in which he'd felt truly miserable. The best cure for love, as Ovid knew centuries ago, is work. Today's third book is Optic Nerve by Argentinian writer Maria Gainza, translated by Thomas Bunstead. I loved this book. Reading it with its art history focus was like stepping into an endlessly interesting world. The book takes us on a journey through history and art and music while we learn about the narrator's life in Buenos Aires. If art connects us to our world, then this engrossing novel serves as thriving connective tissue. The first pages of Optic Nerve. Druce, dear. I first encountered Druce on an afternoon in autumn, the deer, precisely 5 years later. In Druce's case, I left the house one day under blue skies, only to be caught in a sudden downpour. The narrow, winding streets of Belgrano were soon in full spate. Women clustered together on the sidewalks, trying to establish the best places to cross. An old lady assailed the side of a bus with her umbrella when the driver refused to open the doors, and before long, the shop owners, watching the deluge through their window displays, brought out the metal barriers they had armed themselves with after the previous flood. I was due to take some foreign tourists around a private art collection. That was my job at the time. Not the worst job in the world, but that day, while I sheltered under the awning of a bar to wait for my clients, a car came past, hugging the curb and drenched me in my pristine yellow dress. Three more plowed through the same puddle in quick succession. The rain stopped as suddenly as it had begun. And of course, who should pull up seconds later but my tourists? They were a middle-aged couple from the U.S. She was dressed all in white and he all in black. Stepping out of the taxi, they looked immaculate, improbably dry, as though they and their clothes had come directly from the dry cleaner. We made our way to a house that had formerly been a small hotel with extensive gardens and was now boxed in between one neo-rationalist monstrosity and a lurid California-style duplex. A porter let us in and then led the way through to the living room, gliding eel-like ahead of us between the furniture. A quarter of an hour later, a hidden door slid open, and the owner of the collection appeared. She looked at me, I looked at her. A game of chicken, she won hands down. She was dressed in gray, and her mouth had the lines of a woman, bitter at finding herself the wrong side of 40. Her nose was more blade-like than aquiline, and on her cashmere sweater she wore a golden brooch of a small creature that, because of the distance she kept throughout our visit, I never managed to identify. She looked me over with the same incredulity she had voiced on the phone the previous night. She couldn't understand why I wanted to come when she could very well show any visitors the paintings herself. In my firm, I was director, secretary, intern, and guide all rolled into one. That was how I kept things afloat, as I had tried to explain, though not in so many words. Quite the go-getter, she had said. Very well, see you tomorrow. And see me she did, dripping grimy water onto the gleaming parquet. She sent for some dry footwear. A few minutes later, a pair of fluffy white slippers appeared, and as I stepped into them, my client's loss of respect for me was complete. My only chance to show them how good my eye was, deliver a particularly insightful commentary, and once I got going, I felt I was doing okay, more or less, until I was confronted with a dapple gray horse, galloping straight at me under pewter skies. I glanced over at our hostess, for less than a second, but long enough. Alfred de Drew, she smirked, mounting a cigarette in an ivory holder with her long, elegant fingers, almost preening. 19th century. Didn't they cover him in college? Of course, a magnificent piece. Two lies for the price of one. I had never heard of Druce, and the piece struck me as little more than decorative. The work of someone technically gifted, but nothing more. My clients looked back at me with identikit American smiles. Their expressions, in combination with their monochrome outfits, brought to mind the fake smiles in Jorge de la Vega's puzzle. Thank you for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed hearing about these books.